Hello, my name is Andrew White, and you're listening to Leadership 2050 from Oxford University's Side Business School. In this series, I'm talking to the pioneers creating a new blueprint for leadership that's fit for the 21st century. Why 2050? It's the date by which climate scientists say we will have either solved climate change or be in an existential crisis. So enlightened leadership is more crucial than ever. In this episode, I'm talking to Sam Gyimah, former government minister and now non-executive director at Goldman Sachs International.
The citizen CEO is the chief executive that understands that whether it's climate, whether it's diversity, equity and inclusion, that they need to be at the forefront of it in order for their organization to be genuinely competitive. And I think that is where success lies for the leader of 2050.
Sam has a background in investment banking and politics. He's a former Conservative universities and science minister, so he understands how to bring these worlds together to create real change. He's also a leader led by his values. In 2018, he was one of only 21 rebels from the governing party to vote against a no-deal Brexit. It was a stand that ultimately cost him his political career. Now back at Goldman Sachs, where he started out in corporate finance, the firm says he brings a diversity of perspective on innovation, environmental, social and governance criteria, and impact investing. Whether in finance or politics, Sam Gyimah is driven by a belief that leaders should serve and transform society, and he believes finance can be a powerful lever for change. So I began by asking Sam, how did he get to where he is now?
So I was born in the UK, but I grew up in Ghana in West Africa. I went to school there, brought up by my mother, a nurse, and came and finished my secondary education in the UK. And I think the context in which I was brought up, a developing country, a nurse, very much a sense of duty and a strong sense of what the world should look like, which got imprinted on me and my siblings, in part because she was bringing us up on her own and we didn't really have very much. And often my mother would say, well, you're not going to have an inheritance. Your only inheritance is going to be the education you get. So make sure you work hard. And so the ethos of working hard, a sense of giving back, was sort of ingrained very much from my early childhood. And that began to influence the way I looked at the world. And as you said, I started out after university at Oxford in investment banking. I then went into the world of small business, helped develop some small businesses, then into politics. It's a sense of what that was like. It was like going from city boardrooms, M&A takeovers, corporate finance deals, to working in serviced offices in Camden to help build small businesses, and then pounding the pavements to get selected and elected as an MP, and then becoming a minister. So it's a hard-fought journey in some ways, but over the course of that journey, developed a number of different perspectives from having been in high finance, seen entrepreneurship at close hand, and then in government. I was in Downing Street working very closely with David Cameron and his team as his parliamentary private secretary initially. I attended cabinet. I was in meetings with him every day. There were two meetings a day, 8:30 and 4:30 p.m. Seeing how government worked very much at the centre. And then as a minister, held a number of positions in education, in justice, where I looked at social reform, and then technology innovation and higher education. So a mix of perspectives, which has, in a sense, reinforced some of those values that I was brought up with, that leadership really works best when you can deliver, if it's in business, financial results, but also at the same time, achieve social impact.
It sounds really interesting story. And it's, as you describe it, you know, it's clear, I think, the different perspectives that you've gained through that, from the UK, through Ghana, through education, through your mother, through the various political officers, through investment banking, through small businesses. I don't think I've met any of my guests that are so broad in terms of the perspectives that they bring. And I'm really looking forward to exploring, you know, how then you see the climate challenge in a moment. But when you look back across that journey, are there certain what I would call crucible moments, moments where when you look back, things really formed in terms of your understanding of the world, and that's really left a legacy in, on you in terms of how you see the world and what you're doing now?
Yeah, very, very good question. There are a number of them, and if I'm sort of to look back at my life in reverse, and sort of over time, I also different things have more resonance with you than others. But sort of most recently, I would say, you know, I was in politics for almost a decade. I took a very clear position on Brexit, which is quite well known. One of the 21 Conservative MPs who voted to stop No Deal and had the whip withdrawn. And that period was a key crucible moment, inflection point in my life, because I had gone into politics and I was on the tram lines of a ministerial career. You know, worked in Downing Street, you know, I'd been in the whip's office, you know, climbing the ladder, developing my profile. And from the perspective of my Ghanaian family, it's like, you're there, you know, keep your head down. And there I was, I go and resign from my job on principle, and which they couldn't understand at all. You know, it's like, why didn't you leave it to someone else to resign? If I mean, you're not the only one who feels strongly about these issues. But I felt it wasn't just a sense of feeling strongly without wishing to relitigate what was and continues to be quite a difficult moment for this country, but it was the sense that a responsibility that in the job I was in, I was responsible for a number of UK strategic interests post Brexit, whether it's space technology and the Galileo program, which is crucial for the UK in terms of an alternative to GPS, the global position system, which is provided by the US, crucial for our military operations, crucial for our industrial interest, where I could see that with our exit, we were sacrificing these interests and the gains who were going to work. In practice, what does it mean? Contracts for British companies, and secondly, and more importantly, being kicked out of a program that the UK taxpayer had funded for years. You know, whether it's our student exchange programs, multilateral scientific research. So my job in the negotiations was to make sure that the UK secured a good position. And it became very apparent to me as I went through that, that that was going to be far from the case. I concluded that the public has a right to know what trade-offs are at stake and therefore what we are sacrificing with the deal that was on the table. And that was a big inflection point. Inflection point, as I said, because of where I had come from, and I should have, in the sense of you should be grateful that you've got so far. But also within politics and the Conservative Party, I had worked in the bunker. You know, I was in Downing Street. You know, I was in the whip's office. So you know, I'd been constitution minister by this stage. You know, you should be as traditional as they come. You know, you're not the sort of person who should go rogue, so to speak. But I came to the view that if you're going to keep your powder dry on one of the most important issues of the time, then what is the point of having the powder? And that sometimes leadership is about helping to shape and forge opinion. It's not just about holding a position and a title. So that, for me, is one of the most recent crucible moments. It lasted 2 to 3 years with huge impacts, not just on me and, you know, I ended up out of politics as a consequence. So there were real life consequences for me and my family as a result of taking that stance. So that was an important moment. And the other moment, if I was to go right earlier on before that, it's when I came to the UK from Ghana and as a sort of pushy 18-year-old said to my history teacher at Freeman College, you know, I think I want to apply to Oxbridge. I hadn't worked out at this point that you couldn't apply to both in the weird higher education system that we have here. You can apply to both at the same time. And he looked at me and said, okay. And Mr. Greenarsh offered to give me extra lessons himself. And after school, you know, he would spend some time with me, give me books to read, essays to write, which he marked, none of which he was paid to do. And it sort of taught me something around how, and I was eventually successful, of course, it's very easy to conclude when things go well that somehow you've pulled yourself up by your own bootstraps and you've worked hard. But actually, often, for every one of us, there is a teacher, a mentor at a critical time that is makes the difference between achieving a dream and ambition or fulfilling oneself. And ever since then, in anything I've done, I've always sought my mentors and my, I call them my pit crew, because I see that as essential to being able to deliver whatever you want to deliver. And I think particularly for leaders, we talk about leaders in leadership as though they are lone individuals, you know, charismatic and with superior abilities. But often it's the leadership team and the pit crew that makes a difference. And so that for me is my thinking has evolved over time, but that for me was a critical moment, not just in terms of the immediate outcome of my education and what I then went on to do, but how it got me thinking about the setup I need in order to do what I want to do in life.
Mm. And you paint a wonderful picture of, you know, from your mother through to that teacher who saw the potential in you and was prepared to go over and above his responsibilities. And then I kind of see almost a reflection in what you did. I love the phrase, what's the point of having powder if you keep the powder dry? And in a sense, there was something greater than keeping the position. And I'm reminded of the words of Jim Collins in his paper on level 5 leadership. You know, for those people who led, it was something greater and more important than the job, the pay, the conditions. And so there's a real pattern there to me of what it means both to have the support, but in a sense, how that leadership is passed down from one generation to another and something of the values of that.
It's very, very, very well put. And I also suspect that given the time in which we live, so many big, complicated issues, it requires leadership that is not just about analytical ability, raw analytical ability, but also what I would call human qualities of leadership without wishing to sound sanctimonious about it. But I mention that because I don't think that is talked about enough in terms of the human qualities that leaders need to bring to their jobs in solving huge, huge issues. And we look at the pandemic, you know, especially in the early stages of the pandemic, there was no data. Not enough data. And many of the skills that leaders develop now is about, you look at the data and the data tells you and you make a judgment based on the data. But how governments were going to think about saving lives and livelihoods were about high stakes judgment calls that needed to be made. And my view that now and in the future, a lot of those judgment calls require more than just what the data tells you, which is certainly in business leadership, kind of where it has been based. And evidence and data is the foundation. It's the bedrock of high quality decision making. But there are other qualities as well that are sometimes not talked about enough.
And this brings us neatly to the topic of the podcast, which is Leadership 2050. So essentially, what's the leadership that's required between now and 2050? So, you know, I think it's clear to me that a position is important to you, but it's not who you are. And there's a set of values that sit above that. So you come out of politics, you find yourself back in investment banking again, an incredibly important part of our economy, but also, as we saw in 2008, something that can cause real problems as well. So can you give as a bit of perspective on how you see the role of an organization like Goldman Sachs, how you see capital markets, and in a sense, what you're trying to do now?
Well, so I'm out of politics 2019, December 2019, and I'm not sure what to do next in terms of my life because I wasn't planning to be looking for employment at that stage. And senior people at Goldman got in touch and asked, do you want to come back? I said, actually, my instinctive reaction privately was, why would I? It's just so much in my past. But as I sort of had the conversations about kind of where the firm was and what it's doing, one of the things that occurred to me, and I think this is not just at Goldman, but increasingly across the board, is how much leading edge organizations have changed and are changing to be responsive to societal expectations. The realization that, yes, you exist to serve your shareholders, that's it, but actually communities matter and your role within those communities matter. And what you do about that matters, and being an inclusive organization matters. So as I began to get my head around these things, and in a sense, these were debates that were not happening so much in politics. You know, you know, when there are big challenges you can have, I was used to the fact that the answer to the big challenges in society is a government response. You know, a legislation here, you know, government spending there. But what I'd realized is actually now you've got this new world in which there is an investment response to some of the big social problems. And Goldman Sachs was very, very committed to being at the forefront of some of these issues, in particular social mobility and inequality and the climate transition. So that made me think, okay, if you are someone like me who, you know, why did I go into politics? And why, it's because I believe in making an impact. And if you want to achieve impact that changes people's lives, you want to be where you've got levers that are really powerful. And finance is an incredibly powerful lever for change when applied in the right way. You know, everything goes back to finance. And so that made, as the more I thought about that, it made it very clear to me that given what I had, which is an understanding of how government works, and background in finance, working with people who've got capital and want to achieve a social impact could actually be quite an interesting way of, at a very personal level, carrying on doing some of the things that I wanted to achieve in politics. If you want to influence the world of education, finance matters. If you want to influence inequality, finance matters. If you want to deal with the climate transition, oh boy. Finance matters. And that once that crystallized, obviously going back to a firm that I was familiar with and knew, but in a non-executive capacity, became a straightforward decision. But it's not just Goldman that I have relationships with. You know, I have a relationship with an impact fund that's investing in food and agriculture that is very much around the transition to a circular economy and sustainable economy and a number of other interests. So the heart of it is, I think that finance is going to be very crucial. Private capital is going to be crucial to addressing the big challenges of our time. And why? Is in part because government balance sheets post the pandemic are stretched. And so there is a limit to what government will be able to do. Secondly, society has moved to expect business to be part of the solution rather than create the problems for others to solve. Shareholders expect it, employees expect it, you know, customers expect it. So the locus for where change can happen is much broader than expecting your local MP or minister to solve the problem. And if you look at, you know, the Me Too movement or Black Lives Matter, not only were they driven by the smartphone, but people were expecting organizations to respond. They weren't waiting for government legislation to solve the problems. So for me, working with capital is a critical part of playing a very small role in addressing some of the big questions of our time.
So essentially, I mean, what I hear is a major transition from what some people may see the city or New York or Hong Kong being, which is, you know, has largely come out of, you know, what they saw through the financial crisis, certain films like the one with, was it Gordon Gekko and Wall Street and other things which have become iconic in terms of, you know, giving a reputation to the world of finance. And I know it's changing. And what you're saying is it has to change even more to not be about, you know, the individual, largely about a bunch of white men who are very well educated. It has to be something which is more inclusive, more open, but frankly, more about serving society. So when you look across the landscape from your perspective, where's the creativity? Where's the innovation? And are there things that if we saw more of, we would start to shift to more towards the solutions than be stuck with the problem?
No, very good question. And just taking a step back before that, I think one of the things the pandemic has done is it's COVID has accelerated the blurring of the lines between business, government, and society. So traditionally what business did is it lobbied government. Government set the tram lines and business lobbied government on taxes, on regulation, on immigration, purely for its bottom line. And the government has become a much bigger stakeholder in the economy post-COVID, whether it's because of the huge loans to businesses, the furlough scheme, the geopolitical concerns in terms of the rise of China, supply chains, and government has a bigger financial, the state has a bigger financial stake in the economy. So that world where business sat there and government sat there, that gap, is diminishing. And with that, business has no choice but to get involved in answering some of these questions. I'll come to a practical example in a second. And business is also under intense scrutiny to do so. So they can't just pay, increasingly it's more difficult to pay lip service to these issues because it's not just your customers or your employees, but you've got rating agencies, insurers, all scrutinizing what business is doing to help address these problems. And you've got sort of enlightened businesses that are realizing that actually, this is not just a case of you might get regulated, if look at industries like mining, you know, tobacco, if you don't respond to these social pressures, and mining and tobacco have been shaped a lot because of where social norms and pressures are. But actually, on a positive note, these social pressures or needs have within them real economic opportunity. And this is a practical example. So you go back about a decade ago and offshore wind and solar was very expensive. You know, where are the returns? You know, and you only want to do it. And there were some politicians who talked about this is only there to kind of assuage our guilt about the climate. But why do we want to make energy more expensive at the time just so that we can accelerate the climate transition? And it was a fierce-fought political debate, but government introduced, you know, a regulatory regime that was transparent, an auction system that worked really well. Private capital saw the opportunity to finance this huge infrastructure for offshore wind in particular. And today, that part of the energy transition, it's a utility. And we've been through that curve where government has basically created the right environment, private capital has piled in because there were good returns to be made, but is also become a huge and positive part of the decarbonization story as a result. And there are many lessons to be drawn from that in terms of other technologies, carbon capture and storage, hydrogen, that are needed, for example, for the high abatement sectors, steel, airlines, for example, where you need the same kind of thinking. Private capital being mobilized in order to get a technology delivered where you need the same kind of thinking? Or how do you get power generation into the global south, you know, India, Indonesia, Brazil, you need to have the same kind of thinking. But the big change is that people who are capital allocators are willing to do this and don't see this as the challenge for government. You know, the 1.5 trillion or so a year that is needed for the climate transition is there in capital markets. What they are looking for is for the right regulatory regime in order to make propositions investable and therefore do it in a way that accelerates the climate transition, but also delivers a return for shareholders.
It's really interesting. And in some ways, it plays very much to your story. It needs people who understand government, understand business, understand technologies, because there's very much a coming together, I hear, as you gave that example of all the parties. But the, in a sense, getting into the detail, how do you create the right regulatory structures, the right tax structures, the right incentive structures that allow that deployment of capital? And I think, you know, what you're saying, I think, gives people hope. The capital is there. The recipe is there. It's just understanding where the recipe needs to be deployed next. But we have seen the examples of where this work. We just need to accelerate their deployment into other areas.
Absolutely. And we need, obviously, we all know we need a carbon price that is going to be incredibly effective in terms of the transition. You know, the EU is talking about a border tax. You know, you've got the EU taxonomy on investing, which is forcing investors to look at their portfolios and really focus on what is green and what is not in a way that also stops greenwashing. So there is a lot that is being done, but we're still a long way off from getting there. And I think that what we do need is, we need obviously private capital, as I mentioned, we need philanthropic capital, but governments to really focus on making sure that there is a landscape that works. And the reason why this is important is, another reason why this is important is we're looking at what is a multi-decade transition. And previous energy transitions haven't been as conscious as this transition has to be and is going to be. And it will permeate every aspect of our lives. And the challenge with going through a multi-decade transition, speaking with my politician's hat on, is if the whole discussion becomes one of carbon abstinence, you know, fly less, useless water, don't wear denim because denim's made with water, you know, eat less meat, you know, sort of a series of don't do's, it becomes very difficult, I think, to sustain public support over decades. Because it's like asking people to give up something for Lent, but forever. And where transitions work is where there are new ways of doing things that are cheaper and better. Sales of electric cars this month in England are going through the roof because suddenly people are like, if I can't get fuel, that's a bizarre way to get to it. I might as well find an alternative way to get work. And if there's an electric car and it's cheaper, I'll get that. The reason why solar and wind energy have just become part of the energy backdrop and the UK can now be an exporter of energy, I think, for the first time in almost a decade is because it's cheaper. Innovation overall reduces prices, but innovation needs to be financed. And that's another way, another sense in which mobilizing private capital across the spectrum. So whether it's early stage venture capital, whether it's capital markets activity to a now incumbent companies like Ørsted was a state company, that Danish company that transitioned to become a wind energy company. So a big transition story. Or whether it's new disruptors like Tesla coming into the market, they all need huge amounts of capital in order to innovate in a way that transforms, accelerates decarbonization and transforms people's lives. And I think without that, it's very hard if the whole transition story becomes dominated by what people should and should not do. obviously we have to change our behavior in the areas in terms of, especially around biodiversity, where it's not just about innovation, but innovation, because of its impact on deflating and bringing down prices and making things better, I think it's core. And that doesn't happen without huge amounts of capital being mobilized to fund the right technologies.
You've given a very eloquent, for me, description of what visionary leadership is about. That sense that you described, the fact that you need to create a vision for what the world could be like. It's not abstinence, but it's transition, is very powerful. Could we just, before we close, flip to the separate challenge that you spoke about, perhaps integrated in some ways, but of people, of diversity, of inclusion, of belonging. I would extend it into people's potential and ensuring that organizations and all that they bring is available to that broad group of people for a number of different reasons. Have you seen things there which you really think are, in a sense, recipes for the future?
I think in the world of business, or most of the parts of business that I see, there is a recognition that actually having a diverse and inclusive culture is good for business. The pipeline is quite thin, especially at the senior levels. And those organizations that are serious about it don't just sit there and say, well, we really want, you know, a diverse board, but we can't find people. They go and actually try and create the pipeline to get the talent that they need. From the point of view of individuals in those organizations, it's also meant the challenges that you face being different in your organization, whether you are an ethnic minority, a woman, LGBTQ, you're not just required to be resilient on your own. Resilience has become something that is shared with your organization. You know, just be resilient and get through it. No, the organization has a responsibility to help you with mentors, build allies, build promotion programs to enable people to succeed. So we're seeing that in what I would say are leading edge organizations who realize that we're going to look back in 10 years' time and it's going to be really weird if you have an organization that is dominated by any one, not just ethnicity or gender, but that doesn't have cognitive diversity. You know, because all those are incredibly important in a world that is very complex, where there are issues that are volatile and interconnected and how you address them. So this is about business, good business, rather than being woke. The challenge is the politics is pulling in a different direction. But I think businesses are realizing that if you want to be a business where your employees are satisfied, your customers are satisfied, then you've got to be on the front foot around this. And I would go as far as saying that if you look at the 80s and 90s, you looked at leaders, CEOs and leaders. Good leader, you probably say they were a rainmaker, you know. Now I think it's going to be the citizen CEO, and the citizen CEO is the chief executive that understands that their job is to deliver for their shareholders and have a corporate purpose. And part of that corporate purpose is around issues of whether it's climate, whether it's diversity, equity and inclusion, that they need to be at the forefront of it in order for their organization to be genuinely competitive. And I think that is where success lies for the leader of 2050.
And I think what's so interesting, when you look across both of those worlds, the world of climate and the world of people, the mirrors or the similarities, doing the right thing and making money on both of those dimensions are not separate. As you say, this is not about being woke or about being green. It's about being future orientated and being very much about the future. What I do see in what you're saying in both dimensions is that there's a need for a different set of skills, as you're describing, a creativity. I'm very much struck by what's happening at the moment in the UK around a lack of labor. And, you know, frankly, it was easy to recruit people. And, you know, I think what you were saying is we have to now move towards developing people. And it's about not just seeing labor markets that are ready and have lots of supply, but actually taking more responsibility for the recruitment of the right people, the development of people to get them to where they need to be, to fill those pipelines, as you talked about. So Sam, we're coming towards the end of our time together. So I'd like to finish how I finished with all of my guests with what I call seven quickfire leadership questions. So the first of these is, which leader from history inspires you most?
Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln, because obviously he signed the Emancipation Proclamation, which freed slaves in America, but more importantly, his ability to surround himself with people who were originally his political rivals, but in order to deliver what he wanted to deliver and not really feel he needed to take credit for it himself. I mean, that's an exceptional example of leadership.
And then secondly, which leader from today inspires you most?
Kate Bingham, Dame Kate Bingham she is now. And the reason why I'll go for her is when we talk about leadership, we don't often talk about problem solvers. And I thought it was very interesting that the person who had to solve this problem of procuring vaccines and deploying vaccines was someone who, by virtue of the fact that she's a venture capitalist, managing partner of a venture capital firm, understood instinctively what it meant to make big bets where some of them may not pay off. But at the same time, that's what was needed at the time. And there she was from the private sector navigating Whitehall, and managed to persuade Whitehall to basically take a venture capitalist approach to vaccines, as a result of which the UK ended up in a very strong position when vaccines became available. And I think you do need that real problem-solving ability that is often not talked about when we talk about leadership.
And what book has made the most impact on how you lead and how you see the world today?
Well, I said Abraham Lincoln is one of my favorites from history. And I think Doris Kearns Goodwin's book on Lincoln and Team of Rivals is an exceptional book. It's 800 pages, so you need a bit of time to go in, but it's all the human qualities, empathy, always feeling you need to take credit, thinking ahead. They're all there, and not just in Lincoln, but in also the other people. And it's interesting when you study four or five people together at a crucial time in history, which is what the book does.
You may have already answered part of question four. So it's, what characteristic do you look for most in those people who are being promoted? So this is very much a Goldman's question in terms of the generation that are coming through into the executive positions.
Well, I mentor some people who are sort of on track to become partners at Goldman and outside of Goldman. And what I always look for is capacity for growth. It's often the case that you try and fix people in a position. Have you ticked all these boxes and then you can then do this job? But capacity for growth, I think, is what really makes people into leaders. Because often when you are in a leadership position, you encounter sort of game time situations where you've got to make decisions quite quickly. And it's that capacity to grow, assimilate new information, form new alliances, I think, is what determines your success as much as the technical skills which you might have developed before.
And then when you look at the younger employees, the people that you're recruiting, what inspires you most about that generation that are coming through, that are going to be in those leadership roles in perhaps 10 or 20 years' time?
The young... I feel so old saying this now. I think the young generation, what I like is, it's a generation that's very focused on the big challenges. You know, it's very hard. You know, if you're speaking to young people now and you don't understand what is needed to address the climate transition, you're falling short. You know, and they don't just understand it; they also live in it and making sure that their lives, in some way, helps deal with this. And I think that idealism and that sense of this is the way we want the world to be. You know, there are those who are Greta Thunbergs in their own way, I think I do admire a lot.
And then linked to that, what makes you most hopeful about the future?
is always the young. It's always the next generation. You know, their view of the kind of world we need, I think today is a very positive one. It's one that I very much agree with, and therefore, yes, it's a time of polarization, it's a time of division, but that's not where the young are. And so that gives me hope.
And then finally, where do you go for inspiration and renewal?
I learn from talking to people. I love people. I enjoy human relationships and getting to know people. And that's, was, for me, was one of the most frustrating things about lockdown. And I think getting out there and just having conversations is how I learn. I'm always interested in what others are doing, what makes them successful, what makes them tick, what they learned from things that didn't work. And in a sense, that for me is regenerative, in terms of just being out there and learning from others.
Sam, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for the insights into your own story, the insights into how you see the world, and the insights into the concrete things that are happening that you see from your perspective that we're going to need between now and 2050.
Thanks, Andrew.
My thanks to Sam Jima. My name is Andrew White, and you've been listening to Leadership 2050, a podcast from Side Business School at the University of Oxford. Help others discover the podcast by taking a moment to rate, review, and subscribe to the series. And if you'd like to hear more podcasts from Side Business School, visit oxfordanswers.org for details. Join me next time when I'll be talking to Jeremy Oppenheim, the founder and senior partner of Systemic, a B Corporation dedicated to accelerating the delivery of the Paris Agreement and UN Sustainable Development Goals. Until then, thanks for listening.